Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Tuesday, July 26, 2022. I'm your reader, Bill Petrosky. In local news headlines, operator of Dubuque Food Bank appoints new leadership. The operator of a Dubuque food bank has appointed new leadership. Davenport-based River Bend Food Bank has hired Nancy Renkes of Eau Claire, Wisconsin as organization's new president and CEO, according to a press release. The release states that Renkes worked as the food bank's chief partnership officer from 2015 to 2020. She has directed a Wisconsin food bank since 2020. Renkes assumes her new role effective October 1. Dubuque's St. Stephen's Food Bank is a branch of River Bend. Marie Ziegler, vice chairwoman of River Bend's board of directors and a former Deer & Company treasurer, has served as interim president and CEO of the food bank since June 1. River Bend works with more than 400 partner agencies in 23 counties and annually distributes more than 22 million meals to children and adults through food pantries, schools, senior living facilities, and other organizations, according to the release. Wait lists, housing shortage among barriers for local Section 8 applicants. Story by Joshua Irvin, thmedia.com. In the 13 months she has spent in the Family Advocates Domestic Violence Shelter in Plattsville, Wisconsin, seeking subsidized housing for herself and her 14-year-old son, the woman often experienced the aggravation and pain of watching others get out before her. I watched several people get places and my heart was crushed because I felt I deserved a place too, she said. The Telegraph Herald agreed to identify the woman by her initials, KR, to protect her anonymity. She was one of thousands in the tri-state area who apply every year for a housing choice voucher known as Section 8, a federal program that covers rent and utility costs for very low-income families. But the housing supply is outstripped by staggering demand, and the program's efficacy is handicapped by a lack of affordable housing stock and landlords unwilling to rent to voucher recipients. Administered by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, Section 8 has a 99% occupancy rate nationwide, and in the tri-states, county and municipal housing authorities report wait lists for the program that frequently dwarf the number of vouchers available to local agencies. At the Eastern Iowa Regional Housing Authority, which covers Dubuque, Delaware, Jackson, Jones, Clinton, Cedar, and Scott counties, 2,699 people are waiting for one of the 983 vouchers already in use. In the city of Dubuque, which uses a lottery to award vouchers on an intermittent basis, 604 people applied in July for the 25 vouchers that were ultimately given out. Some housing authorities close their wait lists when demand gets too great. In Illinois, Joe Davis County's program closed in 2017 with 637 people on the wait list and is not reopened. Once it gets to a point where you can't get people housed within a year, it should be closed, Joe Davis County Housing Representative Chanel Handel said, which it'll probably take longer than that. Shelters such as Family Advocates attend to many of those on the wait list. They also see how few receive vouchers. There are several times where people have left the area because they can't find affordable housing, can't find an apartment that meets the requirement of the vouchers, or simply being denied a voucher, said Darlene Masters, Family Advocates Executive Director. KR applied in June 2021 and received a voucher in October. Plattsville, which has its own housing authority, has a relatively short waiting time for vouchers at 6 months. The average in Wisconsin is 30 months. But a voucher does not guarantee an apartment. The voucher is only good for 60 days under federal rules, and housing authorities can limit the number of extensions a voucher holder can receive. In the city of Dubuque, already in the middle of what some officials have called a housing crisis, only 63% of voucher holders successfully use them, according to Assistant Housing Supervisor Gina Hodgson. Jen Weber, who runs the Plattsville Housing Authority, takes pride in a successful placement rate of 78%. She says she's been told by HUD's Milwaukee office the average is around 50%. In Plattsville, housing costs are affected by college students at the University of Wisconsin campus, putting a strain on Weber's fair market rent allowance, which is based off the much lower average rent of surrounding Grant County. Finding a unit and finding an affordable unit in Platteville is a big challenge, Weber said. In addition, landlords can freely reject Section 8 vouchers. In Iowa, the right to do so is even protected by law, and often do so either because the rent subsidy rate set by HUD is too low, negative perceptions of voucher holders in general, or something in a tenant's background. The latter is what almost derailed KR. She said she had deferred charges for driving under the influence and a first offense for methamphetamine use from April 2021, shortly before she went into the shelter. The deferred charge will be scrubbed from her record when she completes probation in September. While it did not stop her from getting a voucher, according to Weber, applicants' criminal backgrounds are evaluated on a case-by-case basis. It was a serious roadblock once she had one. She said she paid a total of $250 in application fees, only to be denied by three separate landlords. I had gone to rehab. I had been a full-time college student. I'd started school. I'd showed them everything that I needed to show them that I'm becoming a productive member of society, KR said. KR was dangerously close to losing her voucher until a Section 8 eligible unit in a transitional home run by family advocates opened up for her. The shelter had to petition the city housing authority so she could keep the voucher past Platteville's typical 6-month limit in time for the unit to open up. Masters thinks there need to be fewer roadblocks for voucher seekers, even those with a criminal background or a history of drug use. There needs to be some kind of program out there for people to tell their story, she said. KR now lives with her son in a 3-bedroom apartment owned by family advocates. She's studying to be a substance abuse counselor and is working on getting a job at school. Under Section 8, she pays $50 a month for rent and utilities, the lowest possible rate. After 13 months in the shelter, she's having trouble being alone in her own place. She goes to the shelter to school to do schoolwork because she doesn't like the silence in her apartment. She still has decades of trauma and abuse to deal with, but things are slowly, gradually getting better. I think there's hope, I do, KR said. I just think it's going to take time. Crescent Community Health Center expands brain care, dental services. Story by Joshua Irvine, thmedia.com. 3 years ago, when Crescent Community Health Center first began offering brain health services, the principal ailments the facility treated were hypertension and diabetes. Today, they are anxiety and depression. For Crescent, that was kind of a victory. If there had been 500 visits from people seeking brain health services in 2019, and then 6,182 visits in 2021, that means the health center is serving potentially hundreds of people who otherwise would not have had access to that care. Crescent is one of 14 community health centers in Iowa, federally supported healthcare centers that predominantly serve low-income patients. Some 67% of patients live below the federal poverty line as of 2020. 48% are uninsured. Only 6% have private insurance, and the rest are on Medicaid or Medicare. The health center has seen visits for brain health increase more than 62%. Growth that population manager Ann Morris attributes to the expansion of the facility's brain health services. That's in part, Morris said, because Crescent is one of the few facilities that can offer these services to lower-income patients. There's limited providers in Dubuque that take Medicaid, especially for dental and behavioral health, Morris said. I think we have to grow with it. And it is growing. Staff has roughly doubled in the past couple of years. Facilities currently being built out, and there are plans for an expansion of dental care in 2023. Patient numbers are expected to grow with them. Poverty levels are growing in Alma Key, Dubuque, Clayton, and Jackson counties, according to health center data. The demand is there, and we're growing with it, Morris said. Part of that growth is offering as many services as possible. Crescent offers family medicine, pediatric care, and pharmacy services that can fill prescriptions written in-house in addition to brain health. CEO Gary Collins wants the facility to be a one-stop shop for its patients. The patient knows that they can come here, and they're going to be assisted in every possible way that they can, from insurance to open enrollment to food, housing, transportation, all those things, Collins said. We listened to them. We heard what their challenges were. And then they're more likely to be repetitive patients. That also means listening to patients who don't necessarily speak English. 714 of the facility's patients last year received care in a second language. Among Crescent's staff are two community health workers who are fluent in Marshallese, along with 9 Spanish-speaking staff members. The facility also retains language line services for patients who speak other languages. Recently, that included a family of 6 who had arrived from Afghanistan. "Word gets out that we're here, and then we just make it work," Collins said. Joshua Irvine is a Report for America Corps member and writes about issues related to poverty in the tri-state area for the Telegraph Herald. Attorneys asking for certain topics to be excluded from Dubuque Man's murder trial. Story by Kaylee Reese, thmedia.com. Attorneys are jostling over what topics can be covered during an upcoming murder trial for a Dubuque man. Mark T. Fischler, 61, of Dubuque, is charged in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County with first-degree murder in relation to the death of Bernice M. Williamson, 80, of Dubuque. Court documents state that on July 15, 2021, Kathleen M. McCarthy, Williamson's niece and Fischler's girlfriend, asked a neighbor to check on Williamson after not hearing from her for a day. The neighbor found Williamson dead in her residence, lying just inside her back door, quote, with a roll of carpet over her head, end quote, documents state. An autopsy found Williamson's cause of death was, quote, blunt force trauma injuries to her head, and that the manner of death was homicide. Fischler told officers that he visited Williamson's residence July 14th to fix a leaky faucet, documents state. Surveillance footage showed no other activity at the residence after Fischler left. Police also reported that the shoes Fischler was wearing July 14th were later located at Key City Recycling, where an employee reported seeing Fischler put them in a box. The shoes, quote, contained multiple small red droplets consistent with blood, documents state. Assistant Iowa Attorney General Douglas Hammerin and Fischler's attorneys, Stephen Drahozel and Leah Latner, recently filed motions in limine asking for certain topics to be prohibited from Fischler's upcoming trial, which is set to start August 9th and last 10 days. The motion from Fischler's attorney asks that Williamson not be referred to as a, quote, victim during trial. Quote, using the term to describe Williamson is unfairly prejudicial to Fischler as it injects inherently negative connotations into the trial, which Fischler cannot defend himself, the motion states. The motion also asks Fischler's criminal history and pending charges be excluded from the first-degree murder trial. Fischler is also charged in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County with possession of methamphetamine with intent to deliver, possession of meth, first-degree arson, and possession of marijuana. He has pleaded not guilty to the charges. In December 2018, an office manager at Terrace Heights found paper towels soaked in a flammable substance and a partially burnt cigarette and a rent drop box, court documents state. After watching surveillance footage, police identified Fischler as a suspect and raided his home, where police found materials consistent with making meth. Fischler's attorney's motion also asked for prosecutors not to mention allegations that Fischler stole from Williamson in 2017. The allegations are not related to this matter and are unsupported by anything other than speculation by the decedent, the motion states. In response to the defense motion, Hammerman filed documents stating that the prosecution did not object to excluding reference to Fischler's criminal history unless he testifies for the alleged 2017 thefts. However, prosecutors object to the request not to refer Williamson as a victim. The prosecution believes the manner of death is not being challenged, and it is clear Williamson is a homicide victim, the state's response states. The issue at trial is who committed the murder. The prosecution's motion seeks prohibiting asking law enforcement if they know a witness personally, as well as asking a witness if they believe another witness is being honest. These statements are asking a witness to comment on the credibility of a witness, and the credibility issue is for the jury to decide, the motion states. Hammerman's motion also seeks to exclude, quote, asking any witness about anyone filing a claim or challenging the estate for Bernice Williamson, as it would be, quote, irrelevant. John Jacobsmeyer, Williamson's brother, was appointed as administrator of her estate. However, Gerald Naderman, Williamson's nephew filed documents in September arguing that he was entitled to property in Williamson's home that he claimed to belong to him. He also sought compensation for work he did for Williamson and claimed Williamson promised to leave him her home. Ultimately, Iowa District Judge Thomas Bittner also denied Niederman's claims, citing a lack of credibility. In response to the state's motion, Fischler's attorneys filed a response resisting the request to not mention the challenge of Williamson's estate, arguing that Fischler should have the opportunity to present a complete defense. A judge has yet to rule on the motion. Authorities say Dubuque County teen hurt when ATV rolls, strikes vehicles. Dateline, Sherrill, Iowa. Authorities said a teenager was injured when the all-terrain vehicle he was driving rolled several times before striking a vehicle Saturday in the Sherrill area. Brody W. Schmidt, 15, of Sherrill, was taken by ambulance to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center for treatment, according to a Dubuque County Sheriff's Department report obtained Monday. The crash occurred at about 2:05 p.m. Saturday on South Mound Road. The report states that Schmidt was northbound when he lost control of the ATV. It rolled several times before striking a vehicle driven by Wayne J. Hess, 68, of Sherrill, south on South Mound Road. Schmidt was cited with failure to have a valid driver's license, failure to provide proof of liability, and operation of an ATV on a roadway. Iowa Senate candidate's campaign takes him to Farley. Story by Eric Hoekstrom, thmedia.com. Dateline Farley, Iowa. Matt Robinson said his candidacy for an Iowa Senate seat has given him much to do when he's not at his day job. "We're getting out and we're doing the work on the ground," Robinson said. "We're knocking on doors, talking with people, getting introductions done, and people are very excited to meet with the local candidate." A Democrat, Robinson, 28, of unincorporated Dubuque County, is running against Iowa Senator Kerry Kelker, R. Dyersville, for the newly created Iowa Senate District 33 seat. Robinson hosted a barbecue and fundraising event Sunday at Farley Community Park. The district includes most of rural Dubuque County, all of Jones County, and most of Jackson County. Robinson said he has been busy meeting the district's voters. "It's an enriching experience to meet those people and hear their concerns and just have a conversation," he said. "I think one of the best things you can do as a legislator is to be a listener and figure out what the people are looking for." Robinson is a construction worker with a company based in Dubuque. "I am a lot like these everyday Iowan blue-collar folks who are getting their day's works done and getting home and trying to live their lives," he said. "I want them to know that they have an ally." Iowa Senator Liz Mathis, D. Hiawatha, attended the event in support of Robinson. Mathis is running to unseat Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson to represent Iowa's new 2nd Congressional District. "It gives us hope that a crowd is supportive of someone like Matt Robinson," Mathis said at the event. "They want him to represent them at the state capitol because he has roots here." Bob Gertson of Oxford Junction, Iowa, lives in the Senate District and attended Sunday's event. "We met Matt through the Jones County Democrats," Gertson said. "For a younger guy, he has a great grasp of the issues." Robinson said his candidacy will continue to seek and meet voters in the district's small towns. "The small towns are where we get our votes," he said. "In my opinion, the people in these small towns need someone who has their back. Rural communities in Iowa are hurting, whether it's their public schools, access, health care, or good paying, safe jobs. They are looking for help. The people who can help are legislators, and that's why I got into this race." Robinson's opponent, Kelker, told the Telegraph Herald on Sunday that her campaign has also been busy. "I've been out meeting with constituents," she said. "The district is made up of 45 rural Iowa communities, and I've been out on the campaign trail." City staff supporters say major Port of Dubuque projects would draw tourist talent to town. Story by Benjamin Fisher, thmedia.com. City of Dubuque staff and potential partners presented details, challenges, and benefits that early planning has showed the city could expect from two major developments being discussed for Dubuque's riverfront. The grandest in scope of the two projects presented is the redevelopment of the South Port into a cohesive working neighborhood with residential and entertainment areas, outdoor space, and multifamily housing, all incorporating the area's history of river industry. This would require major infrastructure development, including moving a street and burying the flood wall, but has also drawn local private sector interest. The second project is the creation of a large sports and entertainment complex on a 12-acre lot just north of East 5th Street, which has been eyed for big developments in the past. This, staff say, would offer the city's only one-stop indoor sports location and attract the lucrative traveling sports tournament business the city largely misses now. Southport Project. The centerpiece of the concept is to redevelop the Southport would be an outdoor pedestrian waterfront accessible from the Ice Harbor to the north and the Mississippi River to the east. What we're proposing is to create this very strong pedestrian promenade that allows a mix of uses on the water, said Ryan Peterson of RDG Design, who created the conceptual design. Picture a boardwalk or waterfront that you may have experienced in larger communities where you can dine under a canopy of trees looking out over the water. The space is currently occupied by East 1st Street, where it turns south to become Terminal Street. So that would need to be removed to allow 1st Street to intersect with Jones Street two blocks west of where it does now. Peterson, that would make room for the promenade, but also create what he called an, quote, urban grid for the private sector to be able to move in and develop commercial space there. The project is conceived as a partnership with the City of Dubuque and Conlon Construction, which wants to be the first company in the new space. One of the largest challenges is you have to attract that first one down there, said Conlon President and Chief Operations Officer Mike Mulligan during the session. We can be that first one in to encourage others to make that investment. Mulligan said he doubted Conlon would be alone for long if the city pursues the redevelopment. We attract talent from all over. Dubuque has a lot of companies who draw talent from all over, he said, but we're stuck against the same wall in terms of finding that next great spot. The creation of the waterfront also faces the issue of the flood wall there being currently unburied, separating the area planned from the riverside. For the purpose of this concept, the flood wall would be buried just as it is in the Northport, Peterson said. Think of this as a wide 24 to 36 foot wide walkway on top of that flood wall. City Council member Katie Wethel asked if the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers would even allow the city to bury the wall. City Project Manager Steve Sampson Brown said he had spoken with the Corps and officials there were receptive to the idea. He also noted that due to the bipartisan infrastructure law passed last year, there is a great deal of funding now available for, quote, new start projects, which this would be. Mayor Brad Kavanaugh also said the significant work needed to be done was not too much for the city to accomplish. When we think about having to work with the Army Corps, yes, that's always a challenge, he said, but they're also a great partner who have worked with us before. Kavanaugh said the Southport project, coupled with proposals at Chaplain Schmidt Island, would create an iconic waterfront in Dubuque. City Economic Development Director Jill Connors told council members they should expect a many-year timeline like that of the historic Millwork District before this project could be realized. The second proposal for a sports complex in Northport could help solve a need or indoor sports space. It becomes difficult to find, Connor said. There's a lot of use of school gyms for indoor sports, but it's not enough. So they're spread throughout the city. So if a tournament comes to town, you have people running all over the city. And that tournament traffic identified in conceptual planning so far is missing in Dubuque. Travel Dubuque said there are tournaments from Milwaukee and Madison that drive right past Dubuque every weekend on their way to Bettendorf, Brown said. The project also would come with an anticipated high price tag of $161 million if the city built it out to the full extent of what has been planned to date. So even if the city preferred to scale it down, council members would likely need private investment. Brown said he is confident of bringing that in from out of town. We're not a big enough city that people from Minneapolis and Chicago are driving to Dubuque every week to look at investment opportunities, he said. But if we can show them that there are investment opportunities that can be profitable and we might be a way for them to diversify their portfolio, there's an opportunity there. Council members were generally positive about both project proposals as they prepare to enter their annual long-term goal setting. Galena Tap House now open featuring beer from 19 breweries. Dateline, Galena, Illinois. Story by Kaylee Reese, thmedia.com. A Galena business owner has opened a second establishment that will feature beers from 19 different breweries. Galena Tap House opened last week at 215 Diagonal Street and is co-owned by Catherine Kuzmanoff and her husband, Rick Schutzebo. Kuzmanoff also owns another downtown business, Miss Kitty's Grape Escape, 242 North Main Street. We decided we would focus on beer and bring a focus to those regional breweries that you can go get to in a decent drive and have a full kitchen too, Kuzmanoff said. We set a 200-mile radius from Galena to get beer from, with an emphasis on places as close as possible to Galena. She said Galena Tap House will start out featuring products from 19 different breweries, including ones as far away as Stephen Points, Wisconsin, and Peoria, Illinois. The Tap House also will have some wines available, and Kuzmanoff said the business will use a jalapeno wine from Galena Cellars and its Bloody Marys. Kuzmanoff said the food menu will start with a few items and expand later. She described the menu as a gastropub style of food. We wanted the feel of a brewery, although we're not making any of the beers, she said. The menu includes poke and biscuit breaded chicken tenders, as well as goat cheese grits with pork belly and a blackberry glaze. Kuzmanoff said the tap house will offer a flight of 3 slider burgers, 1 beef, 1 pork belly, and 1 tuna. Kuzmanoff said she and Schatzabe bought the building in December 2020. We had seen the building for sale a few years, and it had gone through a few different owners in the last 10 to 20 years, she said. We decided to take a look at it and see what condition it was in the hopes of saving another building downtown. Initially, the couple thought about using the space to offer brewery tours, since so many new breweries have opened up in the area in recent years. Then, as we were thinking about that, we thought we should put a bar in the business here, get people in before and after the tours, Kuzmanoff said. Then we thought the setup needed to be a full restaurant. Kuzmanoff said brewery tours still may occur at the business in the future, but nothing formal has been set up. Alana Turner, vice president of Galena Downtown Business Association, said the Galena Tap House would be a nice addition to the community, noting that it is one of the businesses open later for those in the downtown area. It gives more variety to customers coming in, and it's something that we don't have currently. Something new and different, she said. The Galena Tap House hours open at 5 p.m. daily. The kitchen will close at 10 p.m. and the tap house will close at 11 p.m. Lunch hours will be added in the future, and there is a fast Facebook page for the Galena Tap House. Here are some biz buzz items. New owners at Galena Canning Company Freight Brokerage Business Moving Sisters opens store in Potosi. A long popular longtime Galena business is under new ownership. Galena Canning Company, 106 and 107 South Main Street, is now co-owned by Jeff and Sheree Holder and Rick and Pat Walsh. The Holders and Walshes are friends and have been neighbors for 25 years. Holder has worked in the food industry his entire life and became connected with Galena Canning in 2006 when he became the business's Cisco Foods representative. At that time, the business is owned by Chef Ivo Puidek, who founded it in the early 1990s. Puidek died in March 2020. His family ran the business after his death, and Holder came on board in January 2021 to help launch the company's wholesale business. Area Freight Brokerage Business moving to Dubuque. A new freight brokerage business will soon move its Piazza, Iowa office to Dubuque. River City Logistics will move into the fourth floor at 131 of 131 West 10th Street across from Sherwin-Williams Paint Store by August 15th. The company also has an office in Reno, Nevada. More than anything, I think we really, really want to continue to show our commitment to the Dubuque community and the Dubuque area, said Operations Director Nick Lester. Obviously, we love Piosta, but it's a space issue at this point. 22 employees work in the Piosta office, but officials intend to double that amount by the end of the year. Southwest Wisconsin Sisters open store in Potosi. Sisters who grew up in Potosi have opened a store together on Main Street. A little bit of everything is open at 108 North Main Street, across the street from Potosi Village Hall and the Police Department. The store is operated under Hometown Sisters LLC, which was started by Potosi natives and sisters Becky Burbach, Betty Leeser, and Anita Blinder. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on Tuesday, July 26, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Merle L. Klein, Deadline Platteville, Wisconsin. Merle L. Klein, 91, of Platteville, died on Friday, July 22, 2022. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Wednesday, July 27, 2022, at First English Lutheran Church, Platteville. The Reverend Brenda Crossfield will officiate. Burial will be at Greenwood Cemetery, Platteville, with military rites accorded by the American Legion Post Number 42 and VFW Post 5274. Friends may call from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, July 26, 2022, at Melby Funeral Home and Crematory, Platteville, or from 10 a.m. until the time of service on Wednesday at the church. Online condolences may be made at www.melbyfh.com. Merle was born on April 3, 1931, in Grant County, the son of Leo and Jesse Bell Klein. He was united in marriage to Alice M. Mester on June 29, 1957, at Peace Lutheran Church, Belmont. She preceded him in death on October 30, 2014. Merle worked in maintenance at UW-Platteville for 33 years. He was a member of First English Lutheran Church, enjoyed fishing, hunting, tinkering with things around the house, and building things for himself and others. Merle is survived by two children, Kevin Christine Klein and Carla Otis Haride, two grandchildren, Cammie Kittrick Reese and Tony Klein, two great-grandchildren, Chelsea and Erica Reese, sister Janice Toby Hubbard, brothers Vernell Klein and Bill Ruth Klein, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his wife, Alice, parents' sisters, Sandy Vondrum and Jane Plumer, and brother Herbert Klein. Arnold N. Merkes, Manchester, Iowa. Arnold N. Merkes, 86, of Manchester, died on Saturday, July 23, 2022. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 28, at Bowen Camp Murdoch Funeral Home in Manchester, and from 10 to 10:45 a.m. Friday, July 29th at St. Mary Catholic Church in Manchester, where services will take place 11 a.m. Marlon K. Mueller, Cuba City, Wisconsin. Marlon K. Mueller, 82, of Cuba City, died on Thursday, July 21, 2022. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, July 30th at Haudenscheid Shield Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Cuba City. A private burial will take place at a later date. Nancy Chapman, Asbury, Iowa. Nancy Chapman, 84, of Asbury, died on Friday, July 22, 2022. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 28th, at Egelhoff, Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road. Services will take place at 10 a.m. Friday, July 29th, at St. Anthony's Catholic Church. Susan J. Thome. Susan J. Thome, 68, of Dubuque, died on Saturday, July 23, 2022. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Friday, July 29th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Platteville, Wisconsin, where a mass of Christian burial will follow. Burial will follow in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, is assisting the family. Here are some listings for funeral services. Dorothy Bastian, Dubuque, visitation 10 a.m. to noon, Friday, July 29th, Egelhoff, Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road, services noon, Friday, July 29th, at the funeral home. Thomas Beckwar, Dodgeville, Wisconsin, visitation 10 to 11 a.m. Wednesday, July 27th, St. Gabriel's Catholic Church, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, mass of Christian burial, 11 a.m. Wednesday, July 27th, at the church. John T. Brenda Mule, Lancaster, Wisconsin, visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 28th, and from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Friday, July 29th, Lancaster United Methodist Church. Services 10:30 a.m. Friday, July 29th at the church. Patricia C. Driscoll, Dubuque, visitation 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, September 24th, Resurrection Catholic Church. Mass of Christian burial, 11 a.m. Saturday, September 24th, at the church. Frederick C. Fangman, Dubuque, visitation 9 to 11 a.m. Thursday, July 28th, St. Francis Xavier Basilica, Dyersville, Iowa. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m. Thursday at the church. Wendy J. Green, Galena, Illinois. Visitation 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 26. Furlong Funeral Chapel, Galena. Celebration of Life, 7 p.m. at Funeral Home. Burial, 11 a.m. Wednesday, July 27. Greenwood Cemetery, Galena. Thomas J. Healy, Dubuque. Visitation 2 to 6 p.m. Tuesday, July 26. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Service 6 p.m. Tuesday at the funeral. William H. Howe, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Services 2:30 p.m. Thursday, July 28th at Evergreen Cemetery, Prairie du Chien. Celebration of Life 4 to 7 p.m. at the Barn Restaurant, Prairie du Chien. Todd M. Kopas, Bellevue, Iowa. Visitation noon to 3 p.m. Saturday, July 30th. Hockman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Bellevue. Lori A. Nelson, visitation 5 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, July 27th, with the family sharing to follow at 6 p.m. Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street. Laura K. Powers, Dubuque, visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 28th, Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m. Friday, July 29th, at the Cathedral of St. Raphael. Vivian L. Quinn, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Visitation 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Friday, July 29th, St. Joseph's Catholic Church, Ann Arbor. Mass, 10:30 a.m. Friday, July 29th at the church. Lawrence M. Richard, Mineral Point, Wisconsin. Visitation 9 to 10:45 a.m. Saturday, July 30th, Immaculate Conception Parish Center, Keeler, Wisconsin. Services 11 a.m. Saturday, July 30th at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, Keeler. Naomi Webster, Shieldsburg, Wisconsin. Visitation 5 to 6:30 p.m. Friday, July 29th, Centenary United Methodist Church, Shieldsburg. Services 6:30 p.m. Friday, July 29th at the church. In other local news, recent sentences deferred judgments in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County. Story by the Telegraph Herald. June sentences and deferred judgments issued in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County. The date is listed on the date is the date of the offense. Jason P. Cullen, 50, assault, December 26, deferred judgment, 2 years of probation and civil penalty. Lloyd B. Beseeker, the third, 51, assault, June 10th, 5 days jail sentence, $500 fine. Charlotte R. Blount, 40, child endangerment and assault while displaying a dangerous weapon. November 16th, 365-day suspended jail sentence. Greg D. Combs, 43, assault, February 20th, 30-day sentence. Brandon J. Dole, 35, third-degree criminal mischief, September 27th, 2 years suspended prison sentence and $855 fine. Chad M. Duvey, 38, possession of controlled substance, May 13th, 365-day suspended jail sentence and $430 fine. Jonathan D. Irvin, 23, unlawful possession of a prescription drug, February 21, 10-day jail sentence and $430 fine. Alexandria D. Evans, 24, assault, February 13th, deferred judgment, 2 years of probation and civil penalty. Dane J. Freiberger, 28, possession of a controlled substance, February 7th. 4 month jail sentence, $1,025 fine, and a DNA requirement. Robert D. Harris, 26, first degree harassment, December 14th, 2 years suspended prison sentence, $855 suspended fine, and 2 years of probation. Martin L. Hunter, 51, domestic assault, May 7th, 365 days suspended jail sentence, $430 fine, and battery program. Justin R. Gents, 39, child endangerment, January 13th, 2017, 10-day jail sentence and $855 fine. Angela M. Joby Johnson, 41, assault, March 19th, 30-day suspended jail sentence and $105 suspended fine. Darwin L. Johnson, 46, domestic assault, October 18th, 2019, 30-day jail sentence with 28 days suspended and battery program. Darwin L. Johnson, 46, third-degree theft, May 11th, 2020, two-year suspended sentence, and $855 suspended. Ryan L. Jones, 29, assault, January 1, 30-day suspended sentence, and $105 fine. Franley T. Coben, 31, domestic assault, third or a subsequent offense, September 2nd, five-year prison sentence, $1,025 fine, DNA requirement and battery program. Tony J. Lester, 42, assault, October 9, 365-day jail sentence with 335 days suspended and $430 fine. Deshaun X. Linder Brown, 20, first-degree harassment, September 14, 2020, two-year suspended prison sentence and $855 suspended fine. Jacqueline R. McWright, 35, two counts of child endangerment, May 29, two-year suspended prison sentence and $855 suspended fine. Vicki L. McMullen, 57, assault, May 9, deferred judgment, one-year probation and civil penalty. Nicholas E. A. Plussell, 31, false imprisonment, February 11, 30-day jail sentence and $430 fine. John A. Pruitt, 38, forgery, July 19, 2021. Deferred judgment, 2 years of probation and civil penalty. D'Angelo D. Ross, 23, possession of controlled substance, December 24th, deferred judgment, 2 years of probation and civil penalty. Tavian R. Schuster, 25, third degree theft, December 14th, 2 years suspended prison sentence, $855 fine, and 2 years of probation. Brandon M. Thornton, 19, third degree theft, May 18th, 2021, deferred judgment, 2 years of probation and suspended civil penalty. John F. Turner, 22, assault, September 26, 2020, 30-day suspended jail sentence and $105 fine. John F. Turner III, 22nd, assault, January 12, 2021, 90-day suspended jail sentence and $430 fine. Johnny T. Webb, 45, assault, March 19th, 5-day jail sentence. Amber L. Wentz, 37, two counts of possession of a controlled substance. April 29th, 5-year suspended prison sentence, 5 years of probation, $1,025 suspended fine, and DNA requirement. Cassville teacher to attend World Congress on Korean War Education. Cassville, Wisconsin. A Cassville social studies teacher has been selected to attend a national conference on the history and legacy of the Korean War. Cassville's Rebecca Mai will attend the annual World Congress of Teachers this week in Arlington, Virginia. The event is hosted by the Korean War Legacy Foundation, which is sponsored by the Ministry of Patriots and Veterans Affairs of the People of the Republic of Korea. Mai and other teachers from across the U.S. will engage with new learning materials about the war, as well as attend historical markers and monuments. The event is meant to help teachers and students understand the origins and outcomes of the Korean War. This isn't Mai's first experience around Veterans Affairs. Last year, a Veteran Wall of Honor was unveiled at Cassville High School that Mai spent several years fundraising, advertising, and planning for. She previously told the TH her interest in Veterans Affairs began when she was a child listening to her grandpa's stories of the Korean War. This week, she'll hear even more stories and witness the unveiling of a new memorial alongside the families of soldiers killed in the Korean War. Solar event planned in Elizabeth this weekend. Elizabeth, Illinois. An upcoming program in Joe Davis County will discuss how solar energy can help individuals and landowners save money. Joe Davis Conservation Foundation, in partnership with Joe Davis County Farm Bureau, will host Solar Show Me the Money at 6 p.m. Saturday, July 30th. At the Elizabeth Community Building. A press release states that the program will discuss community solar and provide an update on the potential economic and environmental impacts of a 1,000-acre, 100-megawatt solar project under construction on the border of Joe Davis and Stevenson counties. Mike Casper, CEO of Joe Carroll Energy, and Garrett Thalgott, attorney for the Illinois Farm Bureau, will speak at the event. The program will also feature a question and answer session with Mark Randall, project manager for Axiona Energy, the developer of the solar project. The release states that doors for the event open at 6 p.m., with dessert served at 6:30 p.m. The program will begin at 7 p.m. In area news, gunman's motive in killing three at Maquoketa Caves remains a mystery. Story by Ryan J. Foley and Marjorie Beck, the Associated Press. Dateline Maquoketa, Iowa. The question at the center of an investigation into the killings of three family members, including a six-year-old girl at an Eastern Iowa State Park by a shooter who later shot and killed himself is why. It's a question that so far investigators haven't been able to answer. They have uncovered little to establish a motive, noting they have not turned up any connection between the shooter and those he killed. What police have said is that the shooter was Anthony Sherwin, 23, of the Omaha suburb of Vista. Police have said he had no criminal history prior to the attack and appeared to target the victims at random. The man's parents, who had been camping with their son, expressed incomprehension that he could carry out such an attack. The shooting happened early Friday morning when the victims from Cedar Falls, Iowa, were found shot to death in their tent in Maquoketa Caves State Park campground. Police have said Tyler Schmidt, 42, his 42-year-old wife, Sarah Schmidt, and their 6-year-old daughter, Lula Schmidt, all died in the attack. The couple's 9-year-old son, Arlo, survived the attack without injury. Police have not said whether he was in the tent when the shootings happened. Mitch Mortvedt, assistant director of the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, said investigators had spoken to the boy, but declined to reveal what the child said. At this time, there's been nothing discovered as far as anything that precipitated the attack at the campground, Mortvedt said. Sherwin's parents had suggested he might have heard the shots and grabbed a firearm in the family's vehicles for self-protection, but Mortvedt discounted the theory. Without getting into the fine details of it, with everything we have learned, we're confident that everything we have reported is how it laid out and that he is responsible, Mortvedt said. Autopsies on the Schmidts and Sherwin began Sunday and were continuing on Monday, Mortvedt said. The La Vista Police Department in Nebraska released records Monday showing that it had only one prior contact with Sherwin when he walked into a police station in July 2017 to report someone had tried to use his insurance to get dental work done in Oklahoma. Sherwin later called police to inform them his insurance company had mistakenly sent him someone else's bill. Sherwin's mother, Cecilia Sherwin, in a statement emailed to Associated Press, described her son as kind, sensitive, and exceptional student and aspiring businessman. We just arrived home and are trying to absorb the loss of our son and arriving home without him, which is unfathomable, she said. I didn't think we had any tears left, but we still find ourselves breaking down and care deeply for the little boy and the loss of his family. $810 million? Worth a lot, $2 lottery ticket? It depends. Story by Scott McFederich, the Associated Press, Dateline Des Moines. Is $810 million worth $2? That's a good question, given it costs $2 to buy a Mega Millions lottery ticket that could pay off with an estimated $810 million prize, the nation's fourth largest jackpot after the game's next drawing. Not really. Isn't it an obvious question? Not really. To start with, your chance of winning the grand prize is minuscule, at 1 in 302 million. You have better odds of a smaller payoff, such as winning $1 million for the matching 5 regular numbers, but missing the Mega Ball. But even that is 1 in 12.6 million. To put that in perspective, your chance of dying in a car crash, something to consider as you drive to the mini market for a lottery ticket, is around 1 in 101 over a lifetime, according to the nonprofit National Safety Council. As lottery officials note, players should think of their $2 bet as a chance to dream while accepting the reality that they likely won't enter a new income tax bracket. Iowa State University Extension to hold local workshops on farmland leasing. Informational workshops about farmland leasing and land management issues are scheduled for several local communities. Melissa O'Rourke, a farm and agribusiness management specialist with Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, will conduct the workshops, according to a press release. The release states that more than half of Iowa farmland is rented, and as much as 70% of land is farmed by farmers who don't own the land in some locations in the state. Local workshops include Manchester at 9 a.m. Tuesday, August 2nd at the Delaware County Fairgrounds. Call 563-927-4201 to register. Epworth, Iowa, 1:30 p.m. August 2nd, Epworth City Hall. Call 563-583-6496 to register. Elkader, Iowa, 1 p.m. August 16th, Keystone Area Education Associate Agency, 140 North 2nd Street. Call 563-245-1451 to register. The workshop cost is $20 per person for registration, and it includes a 100-page workbook. Walk-in participants will be charged $25. National Night Out event set for next week in Dubuque. A free annual event promoting crime prevention, safety, and neighborhood unity will be held next week in Dubuque. The city's National Night Out event will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, August 2nd at Jackson Park, 1500 Main Street, according to a press release. Police and fire department vehicles will be displayed. The event also includes food, games, and other activities. The Visiting Nurse Association will be offering COVID-19 vaccines to anyone 12 years of age or older. HTLF reports strong quarter, positive future outlook. Story by Ali Hinga, thmedia.com. Officials for a Dubuque headquartered financial institution on Monday celebrated an, quote, outstanding second quarter that they said provides significant momentum going forward. Officials for HTLF, formerly known as Heartland Financial USA, reported continued loan, deposit, and asset growth for the year so far as of close of the quarter that ended June 30th. We have momentum, Bruce Lee, president and CEO of HTLF, said Monday during a quarterly earnings conference call. We're executing our strategies, which are delivering excellent results. The company reported total assets of $19.7 billion at the end of the quarter, up 2% from $19.3 billion at the end of 2021. Total deposits increased to a record $17.2 billion, up from $16.4 billion at the close of 2021, and marking the 13th consecutive quarter of deposit growth. Organic loan growth increased by $552 million. Quote, we really had solid growth across our entire footprint, Lee said. For the first time since I can remember, all 11 of our banks had organic growth. HTLF's net income for the recently completed quarter was $49.9 million, down 16% from $59.6 million in the same quarter last year. Lee and Chief Financial Officer Brian McKeag said that that decrease could be traced back to the releasing of reserves and the end of the federal Paycheck Protection Program last year that provided loans to businesses to help retain employees earlier in the COVID-19 pandemic. McKeag said that when accounting for those factors, HTLF had a better quarter than one year prior. We hit on all cylinders, and credit remains really strong, he told Telegraph Herald following the conference call. Lee said the most recent quarter marked the fifth in a row of solid loan growth, and that HTLF has benefited from increasing interest rates and has also worked to control expenses. Lee also provided an update on HTLF's plans to consolidate the company's 11 bank charters. The company's board previously approved consolidating the charters from one base in Colorado. The move aims to improve operating efficiency and capacity and is expected to save HTLF $20 million annually when consolidation is completed. HTLF officials executed the first consolidation last month with Colorado-based Citywide Bank, which is now operating as a division of HTLF Bank. Four more banks are expected to convert this year with an aim to complete the consolidation by late 2023. Looking forward, Lee said HTLF's customers feel good about the economy through 2022. McKeag said company's leaders believe revenue will continue to increase going forward. We believe we've got the momentum that revenue will continue to improve, and we think the bottom line will continue to improve as well, he said. Norwich shares vision for more sustainable ag system during Dubuque visit. Story by Benjamin Fisher, thmedia.com. Democrat John Norwood, running for Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, said in a Monday stop in Dubuque that he envisions an agricultural system in Iowa that is more resilient, diversified, and empowering than it is now. Norwood faces incumbent Republican Secretary Mike Naig to lead the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. A current Polk County Soil and Water Commissioner, Norwood is also a business transformation consultant who works with Iowans in many areas of the agricultural system, including local foods, renewable energy, specialty feeds, market development, and soil health. His campaign slogan is, Iowa is built to last, which he hopes to help the state become. Norwood said the status quo agricultural system is vulnerable to several developing global trends. Specifically, he is concerned about impacts of climate change, changing diets of younger generations, and an automobile industry focused on electrification, not reengineering ethanol engines for more ethanol. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Tuesday, July 26, 2022. I'm your reader, Bill Petrosky. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great day.